The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, for some, Scrabble is more than just a board game. We'll attend a competitive tournament. We'll learn about a recent high school graduate who has devoted himself to recording the stories of veterans. And NASA's James Webb Space Telescope is marking 2 years of science operations. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. For some, Scrabble is more than a Sunday afternoon board game. Competitive players from across the country and around the world make a community of word enthusiasts. Players from near and far convened in Albany, New York for a 5-day tournament this month. I met some of the newbies and nationally ranked players searching for a bingo. Hundreds of letter tiles clacked together in their pouches as the first players kicked off a 5-day 4th of July Scrabble tournament in Albany. Some of the world's top competitors assembled in New York's capital city for the event hosted by volunteer-run organization Let's Play Scrabble. As tournament co-director Kieran O'Connor explains, the tournament is open to everyone.
We have two or three new players from the Albany area playing here today. But we have people coming as far as, we have four people coming from Nigeria, two from Uganda, along with a couple of guys from California. We got people from everywhere.
For Dalton Hoffine, the experience of competing alongside some of the most superior Scrabblers is something new.
This is my very first competitive tournament. Very excited about it. Much less intimidating than I thought it would be when I came in. I came in all nerves, but everybody has been great. I've made some new friends already. It's a wonderful time.
But new players need not worry about being paired against a ranked pro in their first matchup, says O'Connor.
I liken it to a baseball analogy. There's sort of Little League, high school, college, and pros. If you're not a great player, you can play Little League your whole life, and you can have fun and hang out with people and get to play. And if you want to study and whatever, then you might get to the pros or not, but you can always play.
As a match between two world-class players is live-streamed in a corner of the Marriott Hotel Ballroom, players and friends reunite for the tournament. Pouch pals Brian Garnett of St. Louis and Annette Oberstadt of Las Vegas met through the Scrabble community that keeps in touch at tournaments and online.
It's pretty close-knit.
Yeah, I would say it's pretty small. Like, most people know who everybody is. Like, it's the same people who go to the tournaments. It's not like the chess community where there's, like, millions of people who play chess. Like,
that being said, I started in the chess community, and that's kind of how I found the Scrabble community, because there is a lot of intersection and interest between the two.
Also traveling to Albany is Montreal-based player Josh Sokol. The 2023 Scrabble Players Championship winner sees a connection to chess.
Pairing Scrabble to other games, I think it's a mixture of the strategic aspects of chess and the psychological aspects of poker. And when you're watching a game, after two moves, it's a completely new game. So every game is totally different. And so there's always new concepts that arise, and it's always interesting to see what's created.
Sokol says he loves two things about the game: words, of course, and counting.
You have to count all of your plays when you're playing competitively, and there's also a lot of probability and other sorts of math calculation that go into being good at Scrabble. So I think that's what hooked me, just the mixture of the two.
Ida Shapiro, an 83-year-old Queens resident, says she took 5 buses to get to the competition.
It gives me something to do. You know, it's interaction with people, and you need to keep at it.
Shapiro says she played Scrabble in her younger years, but not like this. And though she says her ranking isn't the highest, she knows a lot of words.
Look, I've won money in the game, maybe $1,800 or something like that. But it cost me about $60,000 to do. between all the traveling and everything, you know, with everything. So, but, and some people haven't won anything. So, you know, it's just,
it's worth it.
It's worth it.
You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. In ninth grade, Luke Basso began documenting the stories of veterans. He created a YouTube channel to preserve the experiences of soldiers who served from World War II to current conflicts. Basso skipped his high school graduation this year to go to Normandy for the 80th anniversary of D-Day. He tells the best of our knowledge's Pat Bradley he's always had an interest in history.
I've always liked history, especially military and political history. It wasn't until 2021 in ninth grade when I started my YouTube channel, Filmpuria, to interview veterans to preserve their stories. I originally wanted to get the last living Korean and World War II veterans, but there's barely any of them left. So I've had veterans from all conflicts, and not just veterans. I've had Holocaust survivors or victims of communism on my channel.
As a student, you could have just gone and talked to them and learned about them yourself, but you've actually done videos and put it on YouTube so that other people can see or hear their stories. How did this grow? How did this become a continuing project?
Well, I never planned on stopping this. I never planned on stopping this at all. It was just more of an in-the-moment thing. I wanted to preserve these veteran stories. And it goes back when it was first a thought. But to go back to the late 2020, I met with Doug Brown. He's a World War II veteran. I wanted to meet him. So there was a parade going on for him about his birthday, I think his 100th birthday. I wanted to meet him, but there was so much happening that day. So the family said, hey, come back tomorrow. You can meet him. So I came back the next day. There's two cameras set up, and the family recorded my conversation with him. And I'm thinking, okay, why don't I can do the same thing. I like making videos. I like film. I like history. I like the military. I like current events. I love all this kind of stuff. So one thing led to another. I got film equipment in 2021, and I started my YouTube channel. And ever since then, I've had people from all over the world on Zoom or in person. Not just American veterans. I've had other veterans on my channel too, or people with historical significance. Most of them say no. I get why these people don't want to talk about this stuff. I get it. War is a terrible thing. Why would you want to recall those terrible memories? But they realize the significance of sharing these stories for the world to see, especially with a lot of the older veterans. They understand what I'm doing and why I'm doing it.
Why do you believe it's important to record and preserve their stories?
There's barely any World War II and Korean War veterans left. Then people need to know what it's like from their point of view, not from like a movie or a textbook or just history class. These are firsthand accounts, and you can know what actually happened and the truth, what actually happened. And some, you know, it's very important for these people to have their stories shared. For people, so people know what they went through. A lot of people do not know what these people have went through.
I looked up, and there they were putting the flag up. Ultimately, the executive officer, the guy in command of the Marines, said they ought to put up a bigger flag. And that one, when that was put up, they took pictures, and that appeared in a magazine. And that's the one that you see is the symbol of World War II.
When the medics came with the stretcher, the three of us, we went to a tent. The other ones, they were wounded. They were crying and hollering, and we helped the others. And then I happened to look to see who's next. I said, oh my gosh, there was a soldier there. He was decapitated. So I didn't look no more. I went to another. But we got hit so bad, and I cannot forget this. Every night, 70-some years, I still think of it. We lost a lot of good soldiers. But like I say, we didn't know what we were doing. We were only kids. I was only 19 then, and it was hard. We went through a lot.
You are capturing a range of memories, and some of them are quite graphic. Were you surprised? Did you get emotional too sometimes with what these veterans were telling you about their experiences?
Sometimes I get surprised of how open they'll be. Sometimes a lot of these veterans have never spoken about their experiences ever in their lives. And then I come along, they met me very recently. They barely know me, and they're okay sharing their story to some high schooler rather than their family members or their friends.
Luke Basso, you decided not to attend your high school graduation because you decided to go to the commemoration in Normandy this year. What was that like?
That was a one-of-a-lifetime experience at the 80th anniversary of D-Day. I know there will never be another D-Day anniversary like this ever again. There's barely any World War II veterans left. They're almost 100 years old. And I'm very grateful that I went to this. I really am. There's people from all over the world I met. There's flags from all the Allied nations everywhere. Everything there represented D-Day. And the French people at Normandy, they're so grateful for the Americans and the Allies who liberated them from 4 years of Nazi oppression.
Did you get a chance to record or interview any of the veterans while you were there?
No, it was pretty hard to do that when there's so much happening all at once. But I got to meet a lot of World War II veterans and other veterans from other conflicts too. So I got their contact information. Hopefully I can Zoom call them in the future or at least stay in touch with these people, because I made a lot of good friends when I was there.
How do you think the interviews that you've done have affected you?
Oh, I learn a lot. I learn a lot. And I mean a lot. I don't want to repeat myself, but I do. Not just from their point of view, but I could learn background knowledge of historical conflicts, even lesser known ones, or even not just from their point of view, but the overall context. I get to hear just what it was really like. When you read these textbooks or when you watch a movie or watch a documentary, they make it so cut and dry. It's not cut and dry. And there's a lot of what goes on behind the scenes that people do not know about at all. So hearing from these veterans, from boots-on-the-ground soldiers to commanders, none of it's cut and dry. It is not cut and dry. There's a lot of what goes on behind the scenes that no one talks about. So hearing this, I learned a lot about all these conflicts.
Luke Basso has recorded about 100 interviews and so far has uploaded nearly 70 online. Basso began his project while living in Chazy, New York, and moved to North Carolina last year. Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge. The James Webb Space Telescope, the world's largest and most powerful, is celebrating a milestone. This month, NASA marked the second anniversary of Webb's science operations with the release of a new image of galaxies nicknamed the Penguin and the Egg. The telescope is an incredible resource for the science community. Those seeking to observe the universe can submit their own proposals to NASA. To learn more about Webb, the Penguin, and the Egg, our Jody Cowan spoke with NASA expert and Space Telescope Science Institute astronomer, Dr. Christina Chen.
The Webb telescope, like Hubble, is an open skies telescope, which means that anyone from around the world can propose to use the telescope. So anyone who has a great idea can submit their idea, and those ideas are reviewed by their peers through scientific peer review. So we convene a very large committee consisting of astronomers from all over the world to go through and read all of the ideas that have been submitted. And they form a ranked ordered list of what they think is the best science to do on the telescope. And they give that recommendation to our director who approves it. And that's how things get selected to be observed on the telescope.
From this last year, were there any standout inquiries or proposals that made it through?
Sure. I'm not sure a specific inquiry, but the thing that has just really blown my mind lately is the popularity of the telescope with the astronomical community. We are about to issue our fourth call for proposals to use the observatory. That means that we've had three so far regular cycles, and the number of requests that we get just goes up and up and up. I mean, it is absolutely amazing. I think the first year in cycle one, we had something like 1,200 requests, And this past year, we got 1,931. So that's actually a record for us and probably for the entire astronomical community for the number of proposals submitted in response to any call for proposals.
What are some of your favorite findings so far?
Oh, well, because I study the formation and evolution of planetary systems, I really love images of young planetary systems. About 6 months ago, you might have seen a beautiful image in the New York Times of a young star called Fomalhaut, which is enshrouded in dust. And that picture showed for the very first time the asteroid belt, which had never been seen at any other wavelengths with any other telescopes. Another one of my favorites is of the young planetary system Beta Pictoris. It's 20 million years old, and they found this filamentary structure called the cat's tail, which they think is created by a collision of comets in the outer part of the planetary system. But, you know, as wonderful as imaging is, I really feel that spectroscopy is very important for learning more. And when you look at the requests that the observatory gets for new observations, usually about 75% of them are for spectra as opposed to imaging. And following on that Beta Pic cat's tail observation, there was a separate observation to take spectra of that system, and they discovered another giant collision in that system. This one much closer in to the star, and so in the terrestrial planet zone, and really only 20 or 30 years ago.
And when talking about this spectra, these are things that would not be visible to the naked eye, right?
Absolutely. So spectra are super diagnostic. So if we think about the light that our eye sees, there's actually a whole rainbow of colors. And so you can spread out the light into red, orange, yellow, green, blue, purple. And if you have a particular material, it'll provide a sort of a fingerprint of colors that it emits. And by doing that, we can tell the chemical composition of gases or even of dust particles. In the observation of Beta Pic, one of the things that was seen were olivine grains. So these are dust grains. So if you've ever been to the green sand beach in Hawaii, at the Big Island of Hawaii at South Point, it's covered. The green sand is actually made out of olivine, which is like peridot, which is one of the birth gemstones. And so we can make connections between not just what the gases are, but also what the dust, the solid materials are made out of, and see that they're very similar to things that we see on our own Earth.
When thinking about this time exactly 2 years ago, Webb was already in space for a number of months with a lengthy and somewhat nail-biting calibrating and unfolding process. Is there a distinction in your office between launch date and operational date when marking these annual milestones?
So you're right. The commissioning period took about 6 months, and that's because the telescope is so incredibly complicated. It had all these moving parts that had to deploy just right to unfold the sun shield and the telescope. And so really what July 12th sort of marks is the first release of observations. So these were the first images of our universe where we were expecting to see galaxies and stars like in nice focus where, we could see what the power of the telescope was going to be. It's very closely associated with we divide the operations of the telescope into annual cycles. So the very first cycle was called Cycle 1, and it's the first year that observations were taken, not just, for example, pretty pictures, but like pictures that the astronomical community had requested. And our cycles run 1 year, and they typically start on July 1st and end on June 30th. So this is, for us, a celebration of the very first images from JWST and, the potential that we saw for how it was going to transform the universe. And then it also marks the boundary between our, annual cycles of operation.
And in celebrating 2 years of a successfully operational Webb telescope, a brand new image was just released from NASA showing a cosmic dance of colliding galaxies. Can you help describe what we're looking at for our listening audience and give us some insight to the significance of this photo?
So the picture that you see are two really beautiful galaxies that are close enough to interact with one another. And they first passed by each other probably about 25 to 75 million years ago. And we expect that they're going to continue to do this cosmic dance with one another for millions of years more to come. If you look closely at the image, the galaxy on the right, it's called the Penguin. It kind of looks like a penguin. And it used to be a spiral galaxy just like our Milky Way. And what happened was it passed close to the galaxy on the left, which is called the Egg, and it became wildly distorted. If you look very closely at the penguin, the eye of the penguin actually used to be the center of the spiral galaxy, and the beak and the back of the penguin used to be the spiral arms. So you can kind of tell from looking at this image that these beautiful spiral galaxies, they're actually quite delicate, and so they can be easily torn apart when they encounter other galaxies. So the galaxy on the left, in contrast, the Egg, it's an elliptical galaxy, and they're actually very dense, kind of like a cannonball, and so it's difficult for them to change shape in these encounters.
And forgive me for this one, but in your scientific opinion, which came first, the penguin or the egg?
Oh, that is a great question. If I had to try to answer it, I would probably say the egg.
It's an incredible image. And in fact, two versions were released, one with near infrared and one mid-infrared. And I think this speaks to the spectra view you mentioned before.
Absolutely, yeah. So there are different diagnostic powers depending on whether you're looking in the visual, like Hubble, or if you're looking in the infrared. So one of JWST's superpowers as an infrared telescope is to be able to see through dust, to peer into regions where there are stars forming. So if you were to look at the penguin in the visual, for example, with the Hubble telescope image, you can see that there is like a dark dust lane that kind of goes across the eye of the penguin and sort of parallel to its back. But when you look in the infrared, that dust lane is gone. You can't even see it because you're peering straight through it into where the stars are located.
Can you speak at all to the process involved to produce these final images from the data that's captured by Webb? Imagining the telescope like a handheld camera, is this the type of image that we would see in the viewfinder?
Yeah, there's not like really a viewfinder for the telescope and its cameras. So essentially, before the observations are made, an astronomer will sit down and look at the area of the sky that they want to observe. And then they'll take the camera and imagine sort of its footprint across that field of view and then sort of plan how they want to step the camera across that area. What gives the images this beautiful color is really the combination of observations at different wavelengths. And so, for example, the longer wavelengths are typically cued to red colors because red is a longer wavelength for our eyes compared to blue. And so it's really, you know, a little bit of artistry how you mix the observations that are taken at different wavelengths to get the colors and this sort of very visual appeal because these are wavelengths that are longer than our eye can see.
I think I understand the concept of using Webb to look back into the universe to get a sense of our galactic history. Can Webb give us a sense of where we're going?
Oh, that's a great question. It's certainly true that the Earth orbits around the sun and the sun goes around the Milky Way. However, so that's a thing that when people are making observations of other stars that they, you know, take into account when analyzing the data. But I think when we think about the universe on a large scale, we're sort of thinking about how the universe is behaving. So essentially, one of the things that we've learned over the decades is that the universe is expanding, like it was born in a Big Bang and it's getting bigger all the time. And the way that this expansion works is that the things that are further away from us are flying away from us faster. And so when we look at them with light, we can make an analogy with sound in cars. So like, you know how when a car drives by you, it goes, right? So it gets higher first as it comes towards you, and then it gets lower the pitch as it goes away from you. So these galaxies are all flying away from us. And so that means that the light from them is redshifted to longer wavelengths. So what used to be light that was created at visual wavelengths that our eyes can see is shifted to longer wavelengths. And so that's what makes JBST such an excellent telescope for studying the distant universe, is because we're looking in the infrared and being able to see these galaxies that are flying away from us at tremendous speeds because they're so far away and they're so old.
At this point, what is the expected operational lifetime of the Webb telescope? And what do we hope to learn before it reaches that end?
So the James Webb Space Telescope is performing absolutely magnificently, and we really expect it to be able to continue doing so for many more years to come. At launch, one of the key things that people were keeping an eye on was how much hydrazine was being used to insert the telescope into the orbit that it has around the Lagrange 2 point. Consumption of that fuel was good because that fuel is also used to station keep the observatory where it's located. And so we thought that that was the thing that was going to limit the lifetime of James Webb Space Telescope. And the telescope was designed to operate for like 5 to 10 years. But because the orbital insertion was so good, we actually expect the telescope to last for, we're hoping for like 20 years.
And this one might be a little more science fiction at the moment, but thinking about this new era of space exploration and the increased commercialization of space, could Webb be a future space tourist destination for those fortunate enough to take a ride outside of our atmosphere?
Oh, my gosh. That's a lot of it's hard for me to speculate. JWST is located 1 million miles away from Earth, so far away from low Earth orbit or places that, you know, the astronauts have been. It's beyond the orbit of the moon. So it's really pretty challenging to get there. No people have been there before, although, you know, spacecraft gets up there for scientific reasons, every so often.
Dr. Christina Chen is a NASA expert and space telescope science astronomer. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Jody Cowan. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1766. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.